Explaining football to the friend who's just there for the nachos? Hard. Tailgating from home like a pro with snacks and drinks everyone will love? An easy win. And with Instacart helping deliver the snack time MVPs to your door, you're ready for the game in as fast as 30 minutes. So you never miss a play or lose your seat on the couch or have to go head-to-head for the last chicken wing. Shop game day faves on Instacart and enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first three grocery orders. Offer valid for a limited time. Other fees and terms apply.
For the first time, U.S. subscribers can stream MLB Network 24/7, including select out-of-market games.
Swing and a drive. It's deep. It's good. Yes!
Stream minor league affiliates.
Home run number one.
Or trap pick number one.
Plus, get MLB Big Inning and live audio for all 30 teams.
Baseball can't get better than this.
Experience the game like never before with MLB Network and At-Bat, your all-in-one baseball destination. Only $6.99 per month. Visit MLB.com/At-Bat for details. Blackout and other restrictions apply. MLB trademarks used with permission.
All right, 8:16 now here on WWL. I was talking about syncing up LSU and the Saints games to WWL, and somebody texted in and said, how do you do it? And I listen, I don't do the app. I listen on 105.3 FM, and I don't have much of a sync problem at all. It's not a lot of time. I guess maybe 8 seconds I would have to guess or something like that, but I usually wait until a kickoff. The kickoff, I get the TV ready, and then I wait until the kickoff is about to happen, and then as soon I hit pause, and then as soon as they approach the ball and they kick it, then I hit play, and then maybe a couple of minor adjustments later, really when a referee makes a call, that's when you can really sync it up great. And I find the game's a lot more enjoyable. We are waiting to talk to Kasan Korban, Executive Director of the Surge and Water Board New Orleans, to talk about what went right and what went wrong. 90 of 97 pumps, somebody texted in. Working means less than the fact that seven were not working. Somebody else said no industrial system is ever designed for 100% uptime. Something is always supposed to be down for planned industrial maintenance. Somebody else said there's literally nothing anyone can do to make the system better without billions of dollars in upgrades and a complete redesign of our infrastructure. What's another text here that's coming in here about the power grid? The council must work more aggressively with resiliency, redundancy, and automation and self-healing that comes with it. Until we do, squirrels and balloons will keep taking areas down. Although, when it comes to power problems throughout the nation, if you do a little bit of research, and look, I kid around with Entergy about the wheel of rodents, right? And is it a squirrel or the wheel of fur? Is it a squirrel or a cat or a chipmunk or whatever it is that caused the power outage? But actually, that's a huge problem for power grids around the country, believe it or not. You can look it up. So let's take an early break here. Maybe we can connect with Kasan Korban at some point. And hopefully Courtney will be ready with traffic on WWL.
It's a good thing baseballs already have stitches, because the way these ball players are hitting them, yeah, they need stitches if they didn't already have them. So the next time you're watching a poor little baseball smacked off the wall in center, keep that little fella in your thoughts. It's hard to be a baseball right now. Baseball is something else. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Explaining football to the friend who's just there for the nachos? Hard. Tailgating from home like a pro with snacks and drinks everyone will love? An easy win. And with Instacart helping deliver the snack time MVPs to your door, you're ready for the game in as fast as 30 minutes. So you never miss a play or lose your seat on the couch or have to go head-to-head for the last chicken wing. Shop game day faves on Instacart and enjoy $0 delivery fees on your first three grocery orders. Offer valid for a limited time. Other fees and terms apply.
823, Tommy Tucker, WWL, talking to Kasan Korban, Executive Director of the New Orleans Surge and Water Board. How you doing, Kasan?
Good morning, Tommy. I'm doing well. Thank you.
You know, I'm rooting for you. I want you to succeed. I really do. And I'm surprised, honestly, just to be frank, that you've lasted this long. If I had bet the over and under, I would have lost my bet because I thought they would have run you off by now. But I admire your tenacity. Let's talk about let me get to a listener question first, and then we'll talk about what went right during the storm. Somebody wanted to know if there was ever a time where you had to wait for manpower to swap generators or pumps because weather conditions were too poor. Were you guys fully staffed the entire time, Ghassan? Was that ever an issue?
No, it was not an issue, Tommy. We were very fully staffed. We anticipated some issues. Obviously, we were roaming the street looking for being close to pumping stations that were not necessarily staffed just because of the way that's set up. Not all our pumping stations are staffed, but we were all hands are on deck. Our staff worked hard, and there was never an issue with staffing. So I don't know where that report may be coming from.
I see a report here from, I don't know where the source of it, but it says Surge Water Board experiencing impacts at several sewage pump stations due to power outages and other issues. Is that about lift stations, maybe?
Yeah, so I don't know if you recall, I explained it a little bit before.
Oh, sure, absolutely.
And I know it's very, very complicated system. We have both the drainage system is extremely complicated to explain, but also the sewer, because we have 84 pumping station or lift stations throughout the city. And as a group, some of the, you know, most of them drain toward one or two larger stations that actually eventually pump that wastewater to the wastewater treatment plant. One of the two broke down. We had a failure within the pumping station. We have two large pumps and two small ones. And the two larger ones failed in the middle of the storm. And what happens, just like it happens everywhere, you know, just like in Jefferson Parish, the system itself fills up with groundwater and rainwater, so it just gets overwhelmed. It's not just wastewater, but it's also rainwater. It's not designed for that, but it that's what happens. Anyway, the two pumps went down, and that really obviously stalled our ability to take on more wastewater. That's why we sent a somewhat of a, you know, mild request from our residents and businesses to, you know, kind of restrain from using large amounts of water for a day or two. And that only lasted for a day or two. Currently, we are using two temporary pumps that are keeping up with the flow. So everything is back to routine consumption across the city, whether it's residential or businesses, and we're working very hard on restoring the two permanent ones that are in the station.
Let me jump in for a second if I can, because I'm confused about this. Are we using pumps and generators interchangeably here? Like I mentioned the one on Woodland Highway, which I'm not really concerned about right now, but I see the lift station, and then I see what is either a generator or a pump. Is that one and the same, a pump and a generator together?
No. Typically, you have a pump that is powered by a generator or by Entergy. So virtually all our pumping stations are powered by Entergy power. They're part of the grid. So if a power outage happens where a station exists, that station is down. And in some cases, we have temporary generators, but that we don't have a generator or backup generator at all 84 stations, unfortunately. It's just sometimes there's no real estate, there's the cost of that. So what we have is a fleet of generators that we just drive around and keep, you know, kind of keep the flow at specific pumping stations low enough to allow us to take on more flow. And then we just move on, and it's just like a roving fleet that we use. We also use vac trucks, which what we relied on in the early hours of the issue, where we would pump down levels at various locations, sewer stations or even Station D, and haul the wastewater to our treatment plant by truck.
You know what I'm getting confused with is when I watch these gold mining shows, a big pump that is gasoline, that is diesel powered, but that wouldn't work for a lift station because you're not pumping it out anywhere else. It's got to be powered to the lift station and the pumps included in that. Accurate?
Yeah, I mean, we may have one or two diesel pumps, but I would say out of the 84, probably 80 of them are just a pump that is powered through Entergy. And there's some that are standalone that you power, you know, you fill it with diesel and you run it, and it's a both It's a pump that runs on diesel, but those are self-standing, but they're very few and far between across the city.
I know you're busy and your time's limited here. You have to come back like you did one day and spend an hour with us. But looking, you know, because I think I know the way you think, and I don't think you're looking to the next storm. I think you're looking 5 years, 10 years down the line. And we talk about the fragility of the system. I want you to come back one day and we'll talk about that, about what can be done. Because, again, as the contractor says, I can do anything you want if you got the money. But we'll talk about the fragility of the system and how a year from now, 5 years from now, 10 years from now, in all aspects of it, be it catch basins, be it the power, be it pumps, et cetera, what can be done to kind of decrease the fragility of the system moving forward, okay?
I would love to, Tommy. And just so you know, obviously we're looking at it both ways. We're looking at the interim solutions and we're looking at the long-term solutions. Obviously, we have to. We're obligated to keep things moving today, but then we have a bigger vision what the city would look like you said, 5 and 10 years from now. And appreciate your compliment earlier about my tenacity.
Well, I mean,
I'm a professional with a mission.
I live here
I'm on
life.
A mission and it's... Yeah, no, I appreciate you recognizing that, and I'm here to solve issues that have existed for a long time.
And
so
a lot of the, exactly. It was here for a long time before you. Thank you, Ghassan. We'll get it together, and we'll come on 9 o'clock hour one day, all right?
Sounds good. Thank you,
sir. All right, we'll take a break, come back, talk to the Corps of Engineers about an underwater sill, and I am surprised that Ghassan Korban is here. I thought, sure, that they would have run him off by now, and kudos to him for staying. Back in a flash, WWL. All right, 8:40, 20 till 9, we are getting ready to talk to the Public Information Officer for Louisiana State Police Troop B, Jacob Pichot, about today being the last day to qualify, or at least to apply, for the academy that they're going to have. Good morning, Jacob. How are you?
Hey, good morning. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Trooper. Tell me what's going on today, the final day to apply for Cadet Class 106, and that's to find some more state troopers, right, and train some more troopers?
Yes, sir. It seems we actually just finished closing one, which is a lateral academy, mm-hmm. And this is the academy that's going to start either while this one's already in session or right on the heels of it. And it's not a lateral, so it's open to anyone who meets a few minimum qualifications. It's a 24-week traditional academy. Those qualifications, they just need at least 2 years of experience as that post officer, the peace officer standards and training certified officer, and they've had that 2 years full-time position, or a minimum of 60 semester hours from an accredited college, university, or a combination of either of those options. They can also have 3 years of continuous active military duty service, and today is the last day to apply. To get your name out there and to contact somebody, what you can do is text JOIN LSP to 225-777-8162 or visiting www.lsp.org. You know, over the past few years, with recruiting everywhere for all law enforcement, I mean, even the workforce and a lot of other industries that some friends work in, there's just not many applicants. And we're seeing our numbers come back up, and we're encouraging anybody who's interested that doesn't have experience or does have experience that, hey, they want to throw their name out there, please contact us and we can talk to you and give you all the benefits, pay scale, and everything that comes with this job. We're encouraging anybody who is dedicated, wants to serve their community.
Well. All right, 8:40, 20 till 9, we are getting ready to talk to the Public Information Officer for Louisiana State Police Troop B, Jacob Pichot, about today being the last day to qualify, or at least to apply, for the academy that they're going to have. Good morning, Jacob. How are you?
Hey, good morning. How are you? Thanks for having me on.
Thank you, Trooper. Tell me what's going on today, the final day to apply for Cadet Class 106, and that's to find some more state troopers, right, and train some more troopers?
Yes, sir. It seems we actually just finished closing one, which is a lateral academy, mm-hmm. And this is the academy that's going to start either while this one's already in session or right on the heels of it. And it's not a lateral, so it's open to anyone who meets a few minimum qualifications. It's a 24-week traditional academy. Those qualifications, they just need at least 2 years of experience as that post officer, the peace officer standards and training certified officer, and they've had that 2 years full-time position, or a minimum of 60 semester hours from an accredited college, university, or combination of either of those options. They can also have 3 years of continuous active military duty service, and today is the last day to apply. To get your name out there and to contact somebody, what you can do is text JOIN LSP to 225-777-8162 or visiting www.lsp.org. You know, over the past few years, with recruiting everywhere for all law enforcement, I mean, even the workforce and a lot of other industries that some friends work in, there's just not many applicants, and we're seeing our numbers come back up, and we're encouraging anybody who's interested that doesn't have experience or does have experience that, hey, they want to throw their name out there, please contact us, and we can talk to you and give you all the benefits, pay scale, and everything that comes with this job. We're encouraging anybody who is dedicated, wants to serve their community, and just be a part of change and to make everything better, please let us know. We would love to have you.
So if you have a college degree and no law enforcement experience, you do qualify for the academy?
Yes, sir. This one is not a lateral. This is just the traditional academy. As long as you've got a minimum of 60 hours from an accredited university. That was like me back years ago when I applied. I was not the police beforehand. I had gone to college. I had been working a little bit, and I decided to throw my name in the hat. So yes, you do not have to be a police officer currently for this.
60 hours, about half a degree, just about, right? I think 128 hours.
Yes, sir.
Degree, something along those lines. So real quick,
yes,
the academy is, you go away to academy or you stay home and live there, or how does that work?
So it's a live in, you go, it's in Baton Rouge at our training academy. And then you go there, like I said, it's 24 weeks. It's a live-in paramilitary-style academy. Mm-hmm. You do go home on the weekends unless there's something that changes training and you have to stay on the weekend, but you do go home on the weekends. And you are paid the whole time.
And today's the last day to qualify. You can just text.
Yes, sir.
Join LSP to 225-777-8162, correct?
Yes, sir. Or go to our website.
LSP.org. All right, Trooper, thank you. Good luck. I hope we get a full class. We'll take a break, come back, talk to David Ramirez with the Corps of Engineers about the underwater sill they're building. Tommy Tucker back in a flash, WWL. David Ramirez joins us now, 0848. Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by David Ramirez, chief of the Lower Mississippi River Branch of the Army Corps of Engineers. Talk about underwater sills, saltwater wedges. How you doing, sir?
Good, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Tell me what you guys are doing and where you're doing it.
So we've been tracking, you know, the upward progression of the saltwater in the Mississippi River for about a month now, and it's reached a point to where we started construction of an underwater sill barrier at River Mile 63.7, which is just below Bell Chase, and that underwater barrier will prevent the further upward movement of the saltwater in the river to protect the freshwater treatment plants upstream.
How do you guys go about doing this? I think I saw a video yesterday of a guy with a, I don't know what I was, if I was seeing stock footage or not, but just tell me about the actual process. How do you go about constructing an underwater sill? And the physics involved here is that the saltwater weighs more than the freshwater, so it sinks, and that's why the underwater levee, if you will, blocks it, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, salt water is denser than fresh water, so it moves along the bottom of the river. In this current condition, we have been low flows in the river, and so the bottom of the river is below sea level for quite a few miles, and so the salt water kind of moves its way upstream along the bottom of the river. And what we do is we contract with dredging companies, and they dredge river sand along, you know, the sides of the channel, the bank, the borrow areas, they call it, where there's extra sand material in the river, and they place that in the deepest part of the channel where the salt wedge is moving and build this underwater, it's kind of like a levee. It's like a berm. We call it a barrier.
So where that levee is, the river is, how wide is this thing? If I'm looking at the river from one bank to the other, how wide is it?
The river is probably in that area about 3,500 feet wide. But the deepest part, what we call the ship channel, where we maintain a deep draft for the large ships, that's a lot smaller. That's probably 1,500 feet wide. Mm-hmm. And so that berm is only sitting in that section of the river where it's the deepest.
But the berm itself, to look at it from the side, would be how wide? I'm just trying to get an idea.
You mean looking at it from one side
it would
to the
be?
Next?
Yeah.
It would. It's probably many hundred feet wide. They place the material underwater, so it's not a perfect design as
right.
you would think of a levee on
right.
the ground. They're dumping the sand in the water, and it settles as it will. But it's many hundred feet wide at the bottom, and it comes up to an elevation of minus 55 feet in the river, and that's a lot to allow navigation traffic over the top of the sill without any obstruction.
I know the water level, the flow is low, which allows for the saltwater intrusion. But how impervious is this underwater sill to the flow of the river washing it away or carrying it away?
So it's designed to stay in place until the river flows increase to about 400 to 500,000 cubic feet per second. Once the river rises above that level, then it'll erode away naturally.
You see, and that's the part I wanted to mention, because it's kind of like nature taking care of itself. Once the flow gets to where you don't need the underwater sill anymore, it will automatically take it away, right? You don't have to deconstruct
it. Yes, correct.
That's an amazing engineering feat. How does this compare to last year, David? Because we spoke to you last year when this was going on.
Yes. So last year, the conditions were worse a lot earlier in the year. We were seeing low water in the river late May, early June, and it extended through the fall. This year, we started noticing it about a month ago, as I said, and then when Hurricane Francine came, some of that rain kind of helped. Some of that rain in the river and, local tributaries helped kind of delay it a little further. But we're not seeing the extent of the low water this year as we did last year. We work really closely with the National Weather Service, and they do a lot of rain and river forecasting. And it looks like the river flows are not as dire as they were last year. So we're hopeful that we can, get out of this. And we typically see river flows increase late October, early November. So we're hoping we'll get to that point without having severe impacts.
I love learning stuff always, David, I do, because so you build it, you don't have to rebuild it once it's constructed, or you don't have to deconstruct it, because it's going to be there after you build it until, correct me if I'm wrong, the river flow is such that it washes it away and it's no longer needed. Yes?
That's correct. It'll wash away when the river naturally increases in flow.
So is there any chance that you will have to build one further up, or farther up river after this or not? Or is it take care of it?
Well, we monitor the river, and based on the river forecast from the Weather Service and our knowledge of how the salt moves based on the river flow, this year doesn't look like we would have to do any additional measures than this original sill.
Mm-hmm.
Last year, we built this sill, and then we had to add to it, we called it an augmented sill. We raised the height of it because the forecast showed that the salt water would reach the sill and overtop it.
But in the same area, right?
In the same area,
yeah.
Yes. We just added to the height of the current sill and we raised it higher to prevent that salt water from overtopping.
See, the light bulb just went off. So once you find the location for the sill, you would never build another one beyond it. You would only maybe have to raise it. Accurate?
That's accurate, yes.
Oh.
Yes, that's right, Tom.
Anything else you want to let us know about, David, before we let you go?
No, just that we've been monitoring this. We're coordinating with the local, the Plaquemines Parish, Orleans Parish, St. Bernard Parish on their water treatment intakes. And, our team is out there ready to assist and whenever anyone needs with this drought mitigation.
So just one more quick question I have, and that is, what would have to happen up north to increase the flow of the river? And are you looking at weather patterns or what's anticipated?
And that's the part of it. We coordinated the Weather Service, and there's just been a significant drought depth in the upper Mississippi Valley, on the Ohio River, the Missouri River, and the upper Miss. And all three of those areas are major contributors in the water we see. And so we're looking at, you know, we're needing a good rain, couple rain events in the upper Mississippi Valley to turn this around. And again, typically we see that in the fall with these cold front systems moving through the Midwest. So we're hopeful that, you know, this year will be a good average year. We'll see those rainfalls, you know, start up in late October, early November.
In the upper Mississippi River Valley, the rain we had with Francine has nothing to do with any of this, accurate?
No, we don't have much local contribution to the river here. Most of our water that falls here moves away from the river. As you know, in the city, we pump it to the lake, so there's no real contribution to the river for local rain.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. 8:55, traffic now, WWO. David Ramirez joins us now, 0848, Tommy Tucker, WWL, joined by David Ramirez, chief of the Lower Mississippi River Branch of the Army Corps of Engineers, talk about underwater sills, saltwater wedges. How you doing, sir?
Good, Tommy. How are you doing?
I'm okay. Tell me what you guys are doing and where you're doing it.
So we've been tracking, you know, the upward progression of the saltwater in the Mississippi River for about a month now, and it's reached a point to where we started construction of an underwater sill barrier at River Mile 63.7, which is just below Bell Chase. And that underwater barrier will prevent the further upward movement of the saltwater in the river to protect the freshwater treatment plants upstream.
How do you guys go about doing this? I think I saw a video yesterday of a guy with I don't know what I was, if I was seeing stock footage or not, but just tell me about the actual process. How do you go about constructing an underwater sill, and the physics involved here is that the salt water weighs more than the fresh water, so it sinks, and that's why the underwater levee, if you will, blocks it, correct?
That's correct. Yeah, salt water is denser than fresh water, so it moves along the bottom of the river. In this current condition, we have been low flows in the river, and so the bottom of the river is below sea level for quite a few miles, and so the salt water kind of moves its way upstream along the bottom of the river. And what we do is we contract with dredging companies, and they dredge river sand along, you know, the sides of the channel, the bank. They have borrow areas, they call it, where there's extra sand material in the river, and they place that in the deepest part of the channel where the salt wedge is moving, and build this underwater. It's kind of like a levee. It's like a berm. We call it a barrier.
So where that levee is, the river is. How wide is this thing? If I'm looking at the river from one bank to the other, how wide is it?
The river is probably in that area about 3,500 feet wide, but the deepest part, what we call the ship channel, where we maintain a deep draft for the large ships, that's a lot smaller. That's probably 1,500 feet wide. Mm-hmm. And so that berm is only sitting in that section of the river where it's the deepest.
But the berm itself, to look at it from the side, would be how wide? I'm just trying to get an idea.
You mean looking at it from one side
to
the next?
Yeah.
It would. It's probably many hundred feet wide. They place the material underwater, so it's not a perfect design as
right.
You would think of a levee on
right.
the ground. They're dumping the sand in the water, and it settles as it will. But it's many hundred feet wide at the bottom, and it comes up to a elevation of minus 55 feet in the river, and that's a lot to allow. Navigation traffic over the top of the sill without any obstruction.
I know the water level, the flow is low, which allows for the saltwater intrusion, but how impervious is this underwater sill to the flow of the river washing it away or carrying it away?
So it's designed to stay in place until the river flows increase to about 400 to 500,000 cubic feet per second. Once the river rises above that level, then it'll erode away naturally.
You see, and that's the part I wanted to mention, because it's kind of like nature taking care of itself. Once the flow gets to where you don't need the underwater sill anymore, it will automatically take it away, right? You don't have to deconstruct
it. Yes, correct.
That's an amazing engineering feat. How does this compare to last year, David? Because we spoke to you last year when this was going on.
Yes. So last year, the conditions were worse a lot earlier in the year. We were seeing low water in the river late May, early June, and it extended through the fall. This year, we started noticing it about a month ago, as I said, and then when Hurricane Francine came, some of that rain kind of helped. Some of that rain in the river and, you know, local tributaries helped kind of delay it a little further. But we're not seeing the extent of the low water this year as we did last year. We work really closely with the National Weather Service, and they do a lot of rain and river forecasting. And it looks like the river flows are not as dire as they were last year. So we're hopeful that we can, you know, get out of this. And we typically see river flows increase late October, early November. So we're hoping we'll get to that point without having severe impacts.
I love learning stuff always, David, I do, because so you build it, you don't have to rebuild it once it's constructed, or you don't have to deconstruct it because it's going to be there after you build it until, correct me if I'm wrong, the river flow is such that it washes it away and it's no longer needed. Yes?
That's correct. It'll wash away when the river naturally increases in flow.
So is there any chance that you will have to build one further up, farther up river after this or not? Or is it take care of it?
Well, we monitor the river, and based on the river forecast from the Weather Service and our knowledge of how the salt moves based on the river flow, this year doesn't look like we would have to do any additional measures than this original sill. Mm-hmm. Last year, we built this sill, and then we had to add to it, we called it an augmented sill. We raised the height of it because the forecast showed that the salt water would reach the sill and overtop it.
But in the same area, right?
In the same area, yes. We just added to the height of the current sill and raised it higher to prevent that salt water from overtopping.
See, the light bulb just went off. So once you find the location for the sill, you would never build another one beyond it. You would only maybe have to raise it. Accurate?
That's accurate, yes. Oh. Yes, that's right, Tom.
Anything else you want to let us know about, David, before we let you go?
No, just that we've been monitoring this. We're coordinating with the Plaquemines Parish, Orleans Parish, St. Bernard Parish on their water treatment intakes. And, you know, our team is out there ready to assist and whenever anyone needs with this drought mitigation.
So just one more quick question I have, and that is, what would have to happen up north to increase the flow of the river? And are you looking at weather patterns or what's anticipated?
And that's the part of it. You know, we coordinated the Weather Service, and there's just been a significant drought in the upper Mississippi Valley, on the Ohio River, the Missouri River, and the upper Miss. And all three of those areas are major contributors in the water we see. And so we're looking at, you know, we're needing a good couple rain events in the upper Mississippi Valley to turn this around. And again, typically we see that in the fall with these cold front systems moving through the Midwest. So we're hopeful that, you know, this year will be a good average year. We'll see those rainfalls, you know, start up in late October, early November.
In the upper Mississippi River Valley, the rain we had with Francine has nothing to do with any of this. Accurate?
No. We don't have much local contribution to the river here. Most of our water that falls here moves away from the river. As you know, in the city, we pump it to the lake. So there's no real contribution to the river for local rain.
Thank you, sir. Appreciate your time. 8:55, traffic now, WWO.
It's a good thing baseballs already have stitches, because the way these ball players are hitting them, yeah, they'd need stitches if they didn't already have them. So the next time you're watching a poor little baseball smacked off the wall in center, keep that little fella in your thoughts. It's hard to be a baseball right now. Baseball is something else. Major League Baseball trademarks used with permission.
Trying to figure out what to eat for dinner yet again? With Knorr Sides and Bouillon as your not-so-secret ingredient, you can skip the drive-thru and do dinner at home. Knorr Taste Combos provide a menu of delicious, affordable, and well-balanced meals that you can prepare in 30 minutes or less. Visit Knorr.com to get quick and easy recipe ideas for your home-cooked weeknight dinners. It's not fast food, but it's so good.